Okay, folks, welcome to Planet Porky. This is the latest podcast up here on Planet Porky. I'm the Porkmeister, and delighted that with me today, Lord Snooty, who is bringing to bear the sort of views that people of his standing have in life. And Snooty, I have to say, before we go any further, how pleased I am with the response we got to the last podcast that went out just a couple of days ago. How nice of people to get in touch and tell us how much they're enjoying it.
Very nice indeed. Always a pleasure to hear from the the Porky Planet fraternity, I suppose.
Following.
Sorority, following, whatever you want to call them.
The nice. Porky flock.
The flock, indeed, is a good way of describing them. And particularly, I think, Porky questioning your golfing abilities after the last episode.
Well, as I say, I haven't really got out onto the course for the last couple of years. And I find that people, you know, when they get to my stage of life, they're involved in business and all that kind of stuff. It's not even very easy to switch off and play golf, you know. When you're involved in a sort of multi-directional industry like we are, you know, we have so many responsibilities technically, creatively, artistically.
Are you not semi-retired at your age?
Well, I'm kind of semi-retired, but I'm looking for new opportunities all the time.
Are you?
And, of course, quite late on in my career, I've been discovered as the face of television. So, of course, I have to watch my looks. And, you know, I don't want to have too much wind on my face on a golf course, you know, which might scale my skin or something like that.
Now How's that TV career going, by the way?
TV career's going brilliantly, thank you.
Is it?
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't realise how popular I was. Although although
it's all going a bit John Lennon here, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Although I suspected I might be. But there we are. Now, I tell you...
Nothing like humility, Mike.
Well, it's hard to be humble when, you know that you're not. If you're, or you know that you have things to offer in life, if you understand what I mean. Now, what I wanted to say to you was, since we've last got together, there's been a spate of people dying who are actually quite in the public eye. But the one, I suppose, that... you've got to feel most for was a guy described as the spiky-haired ambassador for British food who collapsed and died at his house in Dubai at the age of 59. This guy was a chef called Gary Rhodes.
Yes.
Are you familiar with Gary Rhodes?
I'm very familiar with Gary Rhodes. Well, just because I think he was a... You know that sometimes there's certain people who you grow up with, as in televisually. And he was one of the chefs that was very much prominent on TV at the time when I was growing up. So I'm talking sort of... early 90s, mid 90s, that sort of thing. He kind of would appear on the morning shows, or he'd have his own cookery shows, that sort of thing, or, you know, showing his latest recipes or whatever it might be. And I also remember, because of course I'm a Man United fan, which I know has turned a few people off, but do carry on listening, I won't mention it again.
Yes.
But he is a big United fan himself, and he opened a restaurant up in the Manchester area, I believe, and was sort of part of it was linking up with the club and all that kind of stuff. So quite familiar with him, and absolutely shocked and stunned that he was he sort of passed away at 59. Seemingly fairly sort of quickly. It didn't seem like there was, it sort of seemed like happened sort of almost overnight.
Well, I have to say I hardly knew who he was because I don't follow chefs on TV. I don't watch the Great Bake On or Bake Off or what it's called.
I suppose Bake the Off, Great British Bake Off, but I suppose when you're cooking, you know, fish fingers every night, Mike, you probably don't need
to watch fish fingers every night. There's nothing wrong with a nutritious fish finger full of protein, and fish are good for you. So I didn't really get into it, but I have to say, for a guy at the top of his profession to suddenly collapse in his kitchen, which of course is his empire, it'd be like you or I collapsing in this studio, you know what I mean? And he had a brain bleed, which I'm told is like a very instant stroke, you know what I mean?
Is that what happened to him in the end? I didn't know.
Well,
seemingly.
From what I can work out, he had this brain bleed, he collapsed, and as he collapsed, he hit your head, and that exacerbated the injury, you know. So it all sounds incredibly tragic. Now, so he was 59, and those guys like Gordon Ramsay, what age are they?
I'd say Gordon Ramsay's probably in his... early 50s, I think he might be about sort of 52, 53,
something like that.
So, similar sort of age.
So does that mean then that this guy, Gary Rhodes, could have been a pioneer then in what I would describe as, you see, the idea of men chefs when I was a kid, ludicrous. We had Fanny Craddock on television, right, with Johnny, you know, Fanny Craddock and Johnny, her husband, who would crack an egg or something like that. But Fanny Craddock, believe it or not, a horrendous name, isn't it?
You know? Oh, awful, yeah.
Yeah, was the only TV cook. And at what stage, Sam, do you think that the general public, you know, people of my generation, suddenly started accepting that men could also cook as well as women. Because believe me, when I was a kid, it was unheard of. You know, the father of the house never cooked the joint. The father of the house never... He sometimes cut the joint on Christmas Day or something like that. But it was, you know, male chefs were unheard of.
That is a really interesting question and one I've never thought of before.
Right.
I reckon it might be... I think chefing is different to cooking, isn't it? In terms of you get cooks and then you get chefs. And a cook, generally speaking, is, I believe, the sort of more menial end of kind of being in the kitchen and working up an evening dinner for the family, that sort of thing. Whereas chefing is a bit more artisan.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that males and females have always done over time. I mean, if you go to a restaurant, it's very commonplace that your chef will be either a male or a female. There's no difference there.
Yeah.
So I guess it's the difference between being a kind of family cook, which is what it used to be depicted as, didn't it, on the TVs back in the 60s and 70s, to being that sort of chef. And actually, I think the whites is almost the kind of thing that, I mean, I don't know how it was, but I imagine people like Rick Stein, who was probably one of the first to do it from the male side, wearing the whites and dressed up, looking like they're in kind of uniform, that kind of thing, giving that element of not just professionalism, but also kind of masculinity.
When I see chefs come out of the restaurant now when I go to restaurants and all that, they've always got those checkered trousers on.
Always, yeah.
That seems to be their sort of uniform, doesn't it?
So you don't think that it's a very manly thing to do then, cooking?
Well, it's something I've had to accept over the years. Because, you know, my mum always cooked the food at home and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I came from a generation where men didn't know how to boil an egg, you know, barely knew how to put the kettle on. To this day, Harry Redknapp says he's never made a cup of tea in his own house, you know. and he wouldn't know where anything is in the fridge or anything, you know.
Did you see that feeble attempt by Boris Johnson to make a cup of tea, by the way, on one of his campaign trail on television? He was sort of...
How can you mess up making a cup of tea?
I don't know, rather haplessly stirring, you know, the milk around the cup, and you sort of think, this is someone who's never even seen a kitchen, you know, it's a quite extraordinary situation.
Well, I shouldn't think he has seen a kitchen, to be honest. That's such a privilege bringing up. Talking about tea bags, by the way, I read in one of my journals.
Not sure where we're going with this. Yeah,
well, exactly. That students now prefer loose leaf tea because they feel
pretentious.
They feel stressed out about tea bags. Honest to God,
they feel stressed about tea bags
because of the material contained in keeping them in bags. You see what I mean?
All right.
So for environmental reasons, they've all gone back to loose leaf tea.
Mind you, students are 90% of the time morons, aren't they?
Yes,
I mean,
I
obviously wasn't when I went to university, and I know that you, for a brief period of time, went to something resembling a university, Mike. But
it was the University of the Trent.
Well, it was Trent Polytechnic, wasn't it?
Years ago, but it is now the University of the Trent. All right. So when we refer to it by its proper title, the University of the Trent.
And how long did you go there for?
I decided after 1 year it wasn't challenging enough for me. I got out and entered the media profession, which was a brilliant decision because I've been very successful.
Well, I mean, that's fair enough. But what I was going to say was, unfortunately, the type of people that I knew at uni, and these are not, I have to say, my friends, because I wouldn't hang around morons like this, but there were people who you hear of and people who I went to uni with who would do things like, for example, put tins of beans in the microwave in the can. And not
without
empty
opening
it. Yeah, without opening it. Yeah, that sort of thing.
What would happen?
It would usually sort of explode the microwave,
Good
you know.
God.
What kind of cretin has to have that much mollycoddling in their life that they can't even operate a can opener and putting the beans in a bowl or whatever before they put it in the microwave? Absolutely ridiculous situation.
Well, my family
even
has an
Snooty
interest.
Thinks that's ridiculous.
My family has an interest in student accommodation down in Bournemouth, okay?
Oh, yeah. Slum landlord, that sort of stuff.
No, not slum landlord. Honestly, I'm not joking. The standard of accommodation our family offers, every student has an ensuite bathroom in their bedroom. Yes. And they're in demand because, believe me, the middle classes have overtaken education because of tuition fees
the cost of education.
Yeah, they're absolutely right. And, you know, you've got people queuing up outside my sister's office trying to get their children into our accommodation because it's so good, you know. It's more expensive.
Is this down on the south coast?
Bournemouth.
Yeah, where I can imagine it's particularly premium rate. It's a very, very expensive part of the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Very expensive part of the world. And when at the start of each academic year, the houses are immaculate because my sister has very high standards. She gets teams of cleaners in all over the summer, you know, and gardeners to do the garden, all that kind of stuff, you know, and every repair possible is made. But I'm telling you, by Christmas, you can forget it. And on one occasion, quite recently, she had to go round after 1 month. And in this place, there were five students because it had become uninhabitable due to the fact that none of the students had bothered putting any of the rubbish in the house into bins outside. Those bins had got filled up but not put out for the bin men to collect, so the rubbish was piling up in bags on the lawn. Inside the house, rotting food and vegetation in the fridges, right? Discarded pizza boxes under the couch, festering. I mean, it was just unbelievable, OK? And she had to write to the parents of all five and demand a one-off extraordinary £100 payment just to get people in to put that house right again. That's standards these days amongst youngsters from middle-class families.
I mean, that is quite incredible, isn't it? So even though it was supposed to be premium accommodation, it still ended up somehow being a slum landlord type situation because they ended up turning it into a slum. Students. It's supposed to be middle-class students doing that.
They turned it slum, but you know what? What the problem was that none of those students had ever been capable of coping for themselves. They'd all come from home, and their parents had done everything for them. You know, I mean, the number of parents who turn up it's de rigueur now that any student living in Bournemouth with a mobile phone, the phone's being paid for by their parents back home.
It begs the question, do you think, and I suppose it wouldn't really matter because if you're going to uni, you're going to be about this age anyway, but do you think people should try and move out by the time they're 18? To try and get some sort of life experience.
Well, I would. That's when I went. When I was 18, I got a job on a local weekly newspaper, decided to start my life on my own, got a flat, a couple of other guys and all that kind of stuff, you know, and did it. The one thing which I think is so... it's not poisonous, but I think so misleading to so many younger people is the blinking gap year. Why, after 3 years of basically not doing very much, just enough to pass your degree, why then do you want a year off to go, you know, travelling around the world and do extraordinary things before you actually get down to the business of getting a job? I mean, my feeling would be, hang on, if I do that, somebody else who's not taking a gap year is going to go and get a job that I could have gone for, and by the time I get back, they'll be a year ahead of me. Did that not occur to anybody?
Do you know, I know people who are in their mid-20s and they still haven't really done any proper work. They're still sort of travelling around, ambling around, trying to find themselves. I think, you know, I appreciate that you kind of want to experience the world before you get too old, but... Yeah. Get a grip, you know, get a job. Stop messing about with your life. I mean, not that they're messing about with their lives, but I just sort of think they're ambling towards nothingness by kind of just sort of travelling around and not really doing anything with their lives. And it just feels like a bit of a waste of opportunity.
I totally agree with you. I totally, the gap year just drives me mad because as far as I'm concerned, you go to university to get a degree to enable you to get a job and start your career. And by the way, there's lots of, you know, tangentials to this one. For instance, I don't know if you saw this week that a lot of very prominent people in life and the world of showbiz and all that went to university, sometimes universities as good as Oxford and Cambridge, and did geography because it was the easiest course to get onto. And what is the point of doing a geography degree?
Well, I mean, what is the point in going to that kind of university if that's the only degree you're going to do? Why not go to a different university and do a better degree?
What do you mean?
Well, if you're saying that they went to Oxford and Cambridge, but like, the only course they could get onto is geography, why not go to a different university and do a better course? Surely that makes more sense, doesn't it?
No, I think it's because they wanted to go to Oxford or
Cambridge.
But why?
Well,
because you go to Oxford, you come out of your schooling with an Oxbridge degree. There is no doubt about it. You are set up for life. You can't possibly screw up. You go to any job, employer, and you say, "Oh yeah, I got a 2-1 in geography at St John's College, Oxford." You're in. It doesn't matter.
But I bet the type of people who are going to Oxbridge are the type of people who would probably put tin cans of baked beans in the microwave. Because
maybe
people who've got no common sense, have they? A lot of these people. I mean, David Cameron wasn't he an Oxbridge graduate? David Cameron.
David Cameron went to Brasenose College, Oxford, where I went for an interview, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Okay, and I went for an interview to do politics, philosophy, and economics, but you know, I decided against it. I went and did other things. Obviously,
was there a point in your life where you were considering being a career politician then, Porky?
No. But it was just the in thing to do in those days. And so David Cameron did it. He got a first class honours degree. Okay, Boris Johnson, who was in the year above him, I think, at Oxford, wasn't at Brasenose, but he was at another college. And Johnson only got a 2-1. And part of their political rivalry all these years has been based on who is the brighter of the two.
Really?
Yeah. Now, Cameron on paper is brighter because he got a first-class honours degree, OK? Boris Johnson did classics and only got a 2-1. By the way, did you know that when Boris Johnson came out of Oxford, his father suggested he might apply to the civil service, you know, and become a diplomat, you know what I mean? So he could have been, you know, a UK ambassador to America or something like that. And talking about who's the brightest, whether it's Boris Johnson or whether it's David Cameron, Boris Johnson goes into the interview, the civil service interview, which everybody has to do, and there's like an 8-page, you know, form that you have to fill out as well as having to write essays and all that. And he filled out the whole of the 8-page form in Latin.
Seriously?
Thinking this will stand out from the crowd, you know what I mean, and make me different and everyone will see how blinking bright I am and all that. Needless to say, they ripped the paper up. Nobody could understand it. Nobody thought it was very good.
It's like a complete prat.
Yeah, a complete idiot, yeah. So, but you can imagine Boris doing that at 21, can't you? You
know? I can honestly say that despite my perceived plumminess, I've never had any desire to go to Oxford or Cambridge.
I've always felt
that they're the sort of... you know, it's going back to the point we were making in the last podcast about the sort of overprivileged, those that don't really have any kind of common sense about the world and what's really going on. The people that kind of, they might get good degrees and all the rest of it, but not, if I'm honest, Mike, the sort of people that I want to be hanging around with.
Well, I loved being there. Well, the interview I went for was for 4 days, and you go and you stay, and it was during the summer when all the students had gone home, and you get your own apartment to stay in, and a bloke knocks on the door at 6 o'clock in the morning with a bib and brace on, a blue one, and brings you a cup of tea.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought, wow, this will do for me.
Not to make it yourself, I take it.
No, not to make it yourself. No, he brought you a cup of tea in. And then you had a couple of days of tests and all that kind of stuff. I would love to have said to me, I mean, for instance, if I'd ever have had children, my ambition would be for them to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And a mate of mine from a little village in Wiltshire, near Marlborough.
Oh, yeah.
He had ambitions to send his son to Marlborough College, which is a very fine school, as you know. And he was a working journalist like me. He couldn't really afford it. He could have done if he'd have made huge sacrifices, but, you know, it's very expensive. So he sent his son to the local comprehensive, but being a rural comprehensive, it was a very, very good comprehensive. And his son got into St John's College, Oxford, to study classics.
Right.
And he studied Latin and ancient Greek, and he's now a very successful publisher.
Well, how much is it for a term at Oxford University these days?
I don't know, but I mean, I think it's the same in terms of, you know, the parents have to pay 9,000 or something like that for the fees and all that kind of stuff. I mean, in my day, when I went to the University of the Trent, I got a completely free grant. You know, I got a full grant to go there free. I spent it all in the first few weeks, obviously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
On drink, you know, and womanising, you know, and good things like that, you know. And I had to get a job in a pub, actually, to survive the rest of the year.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you do much work in the pub?
Oh, yeah, 19th and 21st Highlanders, it was called, in Lenton in Nottingham.
All right.
And I used to work there 2 nights a week. So I got a lot of free beer, met a lot of young ladies, you know, in the pub and all that. I like work anyway, so I did a bit of work, and it made me a few bob, so that was all right. So, yes, the life of a student. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. I'm the Porkmeister. I, of course, rule here on Planet Porky, but delighted to say that my chief and principal guest at the moment up here in the stratosphere is Lord Snooty. Snooty, we're getting through these subjects which matter. One of them there was students. Now, that student one started off by talking about the spiky-haired British ambassador for food who sadly died, Gary Rhodes.
Yes.
And I preceded that by saying to you, there seemed to be a spate of these deaths of popular people. Now, another guy who's died, who I never really came across, is a guy called Jonathan Miller. Are you familiar with him at all?
That name rings a bell.
Rings a bell, but that's all it rang a bell with me. But he was called Sir Jonathan Miller at the end of his life. He was apparently part of the old, you know, Peter Sellers, Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, you know, sort of, you know, genius comedian and all that. I've never heard of him. I've hardly ever heard of him.
No. I mean, Why haven't we heard of him?
Is well, I don't know, but all I'm saying is I read every newspaper every day, and when a guy gets his face on the front of the Times because he's died in place of Gary Rhodes, then you think, well, he must have been quite important somewhere. We'll forget him because neither of us know much about him. The other guy who died, and this all happened on the same day.
Was always happens in threes, doesn't it?
It does happen in threes, yeah, you're absolutely right. Clive James.
Now, yes.
Do you think much of Clive James?
Well, my folks are a big fan of Clive James,
right.
So I was always kind of fairly familiar with his work. He was
yes.
quite good. I think he had a chat show back in the sort of 90s. I think he pretty much did UK TV.
I think he did have a chat show, but also he had another one of these whimsical shows, the sort of thing that these days Harry Hill does. You know, get a TV clip, you know what I mean? You watch it, and then he gives his acerbic interpretation of, you know.
Am I right in thinking? I think I am.
He was Australian.
He was Australian. And he presented at the end of his show
a
rather kind of pathetic singer called Margarita Prakatan. Does that ring any bells to you?
What?
Yeah, there was like a kind of... Was she kind of like faux Greek or something? And she was kind of useless.
Yeah.
And she would do stuff like... I want to say she did stuff like, you know, the Lambada or something like that. And she was this very kind of camp and all singing, all dancing type singer. But she was completely useless, and he kind of presented her at the end of the show. I think that's absolutely right, yeah.
Right.
Very bizarre situation because... He was big in Australia as well, wasn't he? I mean, he was Australian, but I assume he was mostly...
Well, I'm not sure he was, because he came over here as a very young man, I think.
Did he?
And he got into that satire-type set that I've been talking about.
Yeah.
I think he had a lot to do with Sellers and you know, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and all that kind of stuff. And I always kind of thought, you know, that one of the reasons why these guys stayed at the top, and the other one we've just mentioned that neither of us really know, Jonathan Miller... was actually the old Boys Network and the BBC. You know, if your mate had gone to Oxford with you and he was inside the BBC or he had a job on a TV station somewhere, he'd get you in and then you'd become popular, but nobody quite knew why you were popular. You know what I mean?
I think that's true.
I mean, look, it's way before your time. It's even way before my time. But I didn't think Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were terribly funny.
Right, right.
Did you ever see any of them?
I suppose you did, no? Vaguely familiar with their work.
But vaguely.
Again, my parents, more my parents' generation or grandparents' generation even. I think they were vague fans of Dudley Moore and Peter Cook.
Yes.
And Peter Sellers, I suppose, was the one that I think people generally
found. Well, he did the Pink Panther films, didn't he?
Yeah,
you know, they stand up today, so...
He was pretty funny, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very funny. Yeah, I think he was, yeah. He was also in a film, I think that's the film I ever saw him in, was that one about him being Choicey the Gardener?
Oh, right,
what was that called? If or something? Or
right,
was
right.
Was it? Or me or something. But he was basically, he lived in the same house all his life, you know, in America, because he was the valet and the butler and the chef and the gardener. Never been outside the house. And then the guy who runs the house died, you know, the multi-billionaire. And then the family come along and say, right, you're out. So he had to go out into the big wide world.
Right.
And it's very funny because he was so unable to face the world or cope with the world. Every time he issued a statement, people thought he was an economic genius.
Oh, really?
For saying things like, in the spring, we must plant the flowers that will flourish in the autumn. Everybody thought this was a fantastic observation on the economy, you know what I mean, and started like buying bonds every time he opened his mouth. I mean, it's a funny film, but that was Peter Sellers. And as you say, not many people know what he's about. Now, I'm going to ask you quite a personal question here, Snooty.
All right? Oh, yeah.
And the question is...
I feel like going to the doctor.
No, it's not going to the doctor.
Dr. Parry.
Well, it's a bit like that. Have you ever had what you might describe, and it could go right back to your childhood, a broken heart in love or war?
Yes, I suppose I have, really.
Right.
A bit of a strange time with an ex-girlfriend. It wasn't a strange time.
I suppose
we kind of, before university, we were together for about a year.
And
it didn't end particularly well because I think... one of us was interested in the other one, as in sort of thinking long term, and then it switched and the other one was interested in the other one, and it never quite met, never the twain shall meet kind of situation.
Okay.
So we ended up kind of not particularly amicably breaking up while uni was on, sort of at the early point of it. And then all of a sudden, we kind of realised that we probably should have stayed together, and by that stage it was sort of too late. So
yeah.
It took me then quite a long time to get over it. And in fact, not that I sort of have any feelings about it now, but certainly when I was kind of back in those days when I was getting into other relationships and stuff, it certainly affected me.
I know the pain. I know the pain, man. I mean, my heart was broken. I had a relationship for 5 years from the age of 16, okay? And I broke it off because I wanted to improve my career prospects, and I knew I had a better chance of going forward as a single man. and it was quite deliberate, but the pain was terrible.
Yeah.
Because then I knew that the girl I was leaving was clearly, because she was very attractive, you know, was going to take up with somebody else.
Mm.
And the first time I saw her with somebody else, that was going to break my heart. Now, the reason I'm asking you this is because I had no idea until I read one of my continental journals that in Germany, such a phenomenon is called Liebeskummer. Liebeskummer translates into German as being broken-hearted, and it is recognised as a medical condition.
Well, that's very interesting.
It is recognised as a medical condition, and you are perfectly entitled to go to a doctor and get yourself signed off from work if you are suffering from Liebeskummer.
Well, that's very interesting. I've heard of people, I don't know whether you have, Mike,
yeah,
who, like, for example, older couples who've been together, say,
yeah,
60 or 70 years,
yes,
and one of the couple dies and the other one dies and they believe it's because they've died of a broken heart.
And sometimes can be within 3 days.
Yeah, like quite quickly
after. There's a wonderful
I
columnist.
I've heard a case of it in identical twins, would you believe, or conjoined twins, yeah, I think?
Yes, that can happen. There was Amanda Platel is a you know, quite a well-known columnist in this country. She writes for the Mail on Sunday. She's Australian, and she's in her 60s now. But she told the most touching story. Her parents were both in their 90s, and they died side by side in hospital beds within hours of each other.
Really? Yeah.
Her mother went first, and her father, who'd been her mother's carer for 2 years, was taken chronically ill, and he died a few hours later.
It's that truly sort of nothing left to live for type situation, isn't it?
Who knows?
You know, how can you possibly cope when you've been with somebody for 60 or 70 years? It's incredible,
isn't
it?
I know. But let me read you this, because I found this so fascinating, and I wonder whether the Germans are right and we're wrong, or whether we're right and the Germans are just... I mean, you don't think of the Germans as a particularly emotional race, do you? well, you don't, do you? I mean, look at the history of Germany over the centuries. I mean, you know, they're not exactly not known like lovers like the Italians, are they? That sort of stuff.
No,
you know?
I suppose the Germans are kind of...
they have ways of making you break your heart and mending it.
Well, I think part of the reason they've been so successful in things like the sporting world, for example, is because they're able to detach their emotions. I mean, if you look about how emotional England gets, for example, when playing sport, or England teams do when they're playing sport, you look at the England football team and that sort of stuff, I think that wearing the heart on the sleeve can sometimes be detrimental to the England team in some ways. It's sort of almost over-emotional, getting themselves worked up.
Yeah.
And I think the Germans have a way of detaching themselves from that. They're quite almost robotic, probably stereotypical, but I think there is an element to that.
But that is completely contrary to broken-hearted syndrome, isn't it? And also, the Germans are ruthlessly efficient in business. That's why they have Mercedes, they have BMW, they have huge engineering firms.
Well,
and again, that is completely contrary to this idea of, you know, broken-hearted, emotional and all that.
But maybe this is the point, though. Maybe it's because, and I'm sure you're going to fill me in with the details in a minute or two, but maybe the point is that because they're not used to the emotion, when the emotion does catch hold, it has much more of a profound effect on them. Because, of course, we are very, in this country, predominantly speaking, very emotional beings, aren't we?
Yeah, we are indeed. Let me read this to you, because I found this so fascinating, and I hadn't come across anybody who'd... I mean, I've got a friend who's in Germany, a chap called Alan Hall. He was a great Fleet Street journalist. He worked out in America with me. I came back, he stayed there, had a very successful career, and then, believe it or not, met a German barmaid in a German restaurant in Manhattan. I'm trying to remember, it was down lower Manhattan somewhere. We all went there for lunch one Sunday. And he'd recently separated from his wife. Okay,
right, okay.
And you know, they suddenly met and all that kind of stuff. And
Fraulein,
Fraulein. That's right. Got to see him more and all that. She went back to Germany. He went back with her, and he's now a very successful journalist in Germany.
Is he?
You know, he immediately learned the German language, and he.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Ich bin ein Berliner, and. Actually, that translated said, I'm a donut.
Yes.
He got it wrong. Ken got it wrong. He said, Ich bin ein Berliner, and he should have said, Ich bin Berliner, shouldn't he?
There we go. That's
right. But anyway, and now he, and by the way, speaks very, very highly of the way of life in Germany and German society.
Have you ever been to Germany?
Oh, yeah. I spent 2006 there for the World Cup. So when you say, have I been to Germany? I mean, I'm talking about weeks at a time in Munich, Frankfurt, Bonn, Berlin. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
whisper it quietly to all our British listeners, but it is a fantastic country, Germany, isn't it?
It is a fantastic,
a wonderful
country.
Place. And it's so, it's as you've just said there, it's so efficiently run, it's so it's so clean in most majority of places.
I mean, even the trains they have are called the ice trains because they're described in English, intercity express, the ice trains. And the bathrooms on them, the loos on them, I mean, you'd really struggle to get the quality of that sort of bathroom in a Thameside apartment here in London. They're just incredible. They're like bathrooms out of a 5-star hotel. Take them, put on the train. You know what I mean? Incredible efficiency everywhere you go. Everything works. Mind you, I find America like that. For me, everything works in America. You know, the first time I lived there in the early 80s, you ring up and say, I want a car. It's out the door in 2 minutes, you know. You go into a restaurant, you order your meal, it's on the table within 2 minutes. You know, incredibly efficient country. Germany's like that as well. So let me read a bit of this to you, Sam, because I know this will fascinate you. If you're going to get your heart broken, make sure it's in Germany, where it's taken so seriously you can even get a doctor's note. The Germans call it Liebeskummer. The dictionary mistakenly translates it as heartbreak, but Liebe means love, that much is true, but Kummer is a feeling, not an event, such as a break. No, Kummer is an ongoing state and runs the gamut of awful emotions from sorrow, pain, depression, grief, suffering and distress. So that all comes into this, what you've just been talking about, really, you know what I mean? Imagine saying to your boss, I'm sorry, boss, I've got heartbreak. I can't come into work today.
Yeah.
And Germans actually ring up and say that to their boss.
So you can't imagine that in Germany that would be regarded very well at all.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Get
How
up and get on with it, type
is
of thing.
It?
Yeah, yeah, very contrary. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, you can ring up a Liebeskummer specialist in the hope that you might get your broken heart repaired. Typical symptoms are you can't eat, you can't concentrate, you're about to lose your job, your mind and all your friends, because all you do is sit there pining, and employers recognise this as something that is hindering your ability to work efficiently in the company.
Well, I suppose in your case, Mike, this would be one third of a broken heart, right?
One third of a broken heart, mate, absolutely right. In the UK, via the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy, you will find thousands of experts on all manners of human misery.
Right.
But in this country, we do not have one single recognised expert on heartbreak. In Germany, however, and in parts of Austria and German-speaking Switzerland, there are therapists who don't just specialise in Liebeskummer. For some of them, it's all they do. It's a measure of how seriously Germans take breakups that if you type Liebeskummer into German Google, you know, obviously the German equivalent of what we got here, the predictive...
Das Google.
Das Google, yeah. The predictive text suggests death. I.e., that's how dangerous it is.
Well, tell you what's most
people might commit suicide and all that kind of stuff.
That's very interesting. And what I think is most interesting about that is that I don't associate Germany with many quacks or many kind of holistic medicines and all that kind of stuff.
No.
You know, you don't really think of Germany and think kind of crazy alternative medicines and treatments, do you? You think of them as being very much kind of matter of fact. If you need some work done, they'll take you to a surgeon.
Yeah.
They'll take you to someone who everything's very surgical, isn't it, in Germany in terms of the way they do things.
Yeah,
so
I
the fact
you,
that they have people who are specialists in this.
Yes.
It's weird, isn't it? It's the perception of the country, perhaps. Maybe if it was in somewhere like, and with all due respect to the place, somewhere like China or Japan, where they're known for alternative medicine,
Or even Holland,
like Holland,
where they have funny fag cafes because everybody's hey man and all that kind of stuff.
But Germany, you don't say that. So maybe it's something we should be, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but maybe it's something we should be taking more seriously.
Well, maybe it is something we should be taking more seriously. In my case, right, I made that conscious decision. I knew that I was going to go through heartbreak and I never got married. And without a shadow of a doubt, the consequence of that decision in those days meant that I never met a woman who measured up to my first girlfriend. Never.
Do you also think that a little bit like from my situation, whereby there was a little bit of a fear of getting into a relationship again for the fear of heartbreak, it's a bit like the same reason why I'm always a bit reluctant to own pets because I can't, like the idea of there being only a sort of indeterminate amount of time where they're going to be alive and at some point there's going to be some kind of misery. Maybe that's the reason why you never got married, Mike, in terms of the fear of a potential breakup.
No, it wasn't that. It was just that I found that when I was in the company of any woman after my first girlfriend, it was not satisfying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't really want to be in their company. I'd be in their company to go out for the evening. I'd be in their company over the weekend, go to lunch, something like that. You know what I mean? But actually, I pined all the time for my first girlfriend, and there was never a decent substitute.
Are you still pining now?
I suppose I am,
Do
really.
Do you need to go speak to a German specialist?
Well, maybe a Liebeskummer. I might go and see a Liebeskummer expert. But no, the point I'm making is that, if I'm making a point at all, I had to balance one against the other.
Yeah.
I had a very successful career in the media. I hope it's still going on. I mean, I've moved into all so many different areas. We're doing this podcast today.
Yes.
I moved into radio in the second half of my career in communications, I would call it. First half of my career was in newspapers. I did very well in newspapers. I succeeded in radio. I'm now spending an awful lot of time on podcasts and other things like live shows and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I can't possibly regret having made that decision in terms of the objective. The objective was to, I mean, for instance, when I was appointed as the Daily Express correspondent in New York, I went because I was a single man and I was 26. There were lots of other people in that newsroom who were a little bit better than me, but they were a bit older and they were married, okay? Mm. And that's why I got it. And that was the sort of thing I was looking for from the day I made that decision to say, right, I've got to be so single-minded about my career.
I guess it's that thing about never loving a woman as much as you've loved your career, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe. And some would say it was heartless, and some would say, well, you know, I don't regret it, in the sense that if it had gone wrong, and if I was still on the Chester Chronicle, because I was never any good to go anywhere else, you know, I would have, every night before I go to bed, I would flay myself with a cat of nine tails, you know what I mean? For giving up the woman I loved for a career that never took off.
Yeah.
But the career did take off. So
I'd like to think that, yeah. I mean, yeah. You very much, it very much stands for you, and I'd like to think it stands for me as well, that we're both quite very career-minded.
Yes.
And I think I have to say that I think you're either, to a certain degree, career-minded or you're family-minded.
Yes.
And I really, really admire those that can do both.
Yes, indeed. Right, okay, folks, you have been listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for being with us. And thank you for all the responses we got to the last Planet Porky. And stick around, because we'll be back with you again in a few days' time. This is Mike Porky Parry and Lord Snooty signing off from Planet Porky. Talking about tea bags, by the way. I read in one of my journals.
I'm not sure where we're going with this. Yeah,
Exactly. That students now prefer loose leaf tea because they feel stressed out about tea bags. Honest to God,
they feel stressed about tea bags
because of the material contained in keeping them in bags. You see what I mean?
All right.
So for environmental reasons, they've all gone back to loose leaf tea.
Mind you, students are 90% of the time morons, aren't they?
Yes,
I mean,
I
obviously wasn't when I went to university, and I know that you, for a brief period of time, went to something resembling a university, Mike. But
it was the University of the Trent.
Well, it was Trent Polytechnic, wasn't it?
Years ago, but it is now the University of the Trent. All right. So when we refer to it by its proper title, the University of the Trent.
And how long did you go there for?
I decided after 1 year it wasn't challenging enough for me. I got out and entered the media profession. Which was a brilliant decision, because I've been very successful. The bathrooms on them, the loo's on them, I mean, you'd really struggle to get the quality of that sort of bathroom in a Thameside apartment here in London. It's just incredible. They're like bathrooms out of a five-star hotel. Take them, put on the train, you know what I mean? They have ways of making you break your heart and mending it.